Picture the Ruth Glacier on a January morning, 1962. The temperature outside is 40 below, and that is before the wind. The sky above you is that impossible shade of blue you only see above 10,000 feet, clear as glass, no haze, nothing but color that does not exist down in the valleys. On either side of the glacier, granite walls rise straight up, 2 vertical miles of rock and ice so close together that in the deepest part of the gorge, direct sunlight only touches the ice for a few hours each day, even in summer. No road reaches this place. No trail, no radio tower, no rescue service on call. If something happens out here, the options are few, far away, and none of them move fast. And then into that silence, you hear it, small, distant, getting louder. A Piper Super Cub drops through the gap between the peaks, skis kissing the glacier surface, sending a rooster tail of hard-packed snow behind it. The pilot climbs out, hands a supply package to a mountaineer, too frostbitten to say more than a few words, exchanges something short and practical, gets back in, and the engine note rises, and the little airplane lifts off the glacier and disappears back into the peaks like it was never there. That was Don Sheldon. And if you know anything about Alaska, you know that name. I am Tail Dragger. This is The Hangar on Radio Hangar, and today we are talking about one of the finest aviators this country ever produced. Not a test pilot, not a combat ace, not someone whose name is on a building at an aerospace company, a bush pilot from Talkeetna, Alaska, who flew places that other pilots simply refused to go, and who left a mark on the Alaska range that you can still feel today. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation Challenge coins for every milestone in flight, first solo private pilot, instrument rating all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Don Sheldon was born in Aspen, Colorado in 1921, orphaned young. Grew up tough in the way that Depression-era kids in mountain towns grew up tough, which is to say he learned early that the world did not hand things to you and that self-reliance was not a philosophy. It was a survival strategy. He came to Alaska as a young man in the years before the Second World War, drawn by the same pull that has brought restless Americans north for more than a century. Something about a place that does not care whether you're ready. Something about country that has not been used up yet. He got his pilot certificate, settled in Talkeetna. And that was the decision. Talkeetna in those years was a tiny town, barely 100 people, a railroad stop at the confluence of 3 rivers. From the streets of Talkeetna, on a clear day, you can see the full sweep of the Alaska Range rising to the north. The peaks push up out of the flats and the boreal forest like the spine of the earth itself. Denali, the one the old maps called Mount McKinley, sitting at 20,310 feet, the highest point in North America. And around it, the smaller peaks, smaller only by comparison, most of them taller than anything in the lower 48. Most pilots looked at that range and saw a wall. Sheldon looked at it and saw a workplace. To understand what he did up there, you need to understand what glacier flying actually demands. Because this is not a short grass strip in the Ozarks. This is not a gravel bar landing in the interior. This is a different category of problem entirely. A glacier is not a runway. A glacier is a river of ice, moving constantly, reshaping itself, constantly changing. Crevasses open and close on schedules that have nothing to do with your departure time. The surface can be hard-packed and fast, or soft and treacherous, and often you cannot tell which from the air. You land, and then you find out. The elevation on the Ruth Glacier runs roughly 5,500 feet. That sounds manageable until you consider that your engine is losing power with every foot of altitude. Your climb rate on the way out is maybe a third of what it would be at sea level, and the walls on either side of you are not going to move if you miscalculate. And the weather. The Alaska Range generates its own weather systems. Storms build in the time it takes to fly from Talkeetna to the glacier and back. Passes that were open on the way in, close on the way out. Whiteout conditions on a glacier mean you lose all depth perception. The white surface blends with the white sky and there is no horizon, no shadow, no reference to tell you where one ends and the other begins. Pilots have flown perfectly functional aircraft straight into glacier surfaces because they simply could not see where the surface was. Sheldon learned all of this by doing it. By flying through conditions that no instructor would have signed off on, in terrain that the textbooks had not yet cataloged, reading the glacier and the peaks and the weather the way a ship's captain reads a coastline. He has spent 30 years studying. His aircraft for most of his career was the Piper Super Cub, PA-18, 150 horsepower of reliable Continental engine. a high wing design that gives you visibility down and to the sides, and a stall speed low enough that a skilled pilot can work it into places that would shock you if you saw them from the ground. He flew it on skis in winter, on tundra tires in summer, and he knew that airplane the way a musician knows an instrument, which rivet was loose and which control felt right, and when the engine was running true. He also flew Cessna 180s when the load required it, more capacity for fuel and supplies, but the Super Cub was the tool he trusted most for the real work.
The relationship that defined Sheldon's career began in the late 1940s, when a cartographer and mountaineer from Boston named Bradford Washburn undertook the project that would occupy much of his professional life: a comprehensive aerial photographic survey of the Alaska Range. Washburn was already a celebrated figure in the mountaineering world. He had made significant first ascents in the range and had a gift for aerial photography that produced images of the high peaks that nobody had seen before. But to make those photographs, he needed a pilot who could put a small airplane at a specific altitude, on a specific heading, over a specific ridgeline, in conditions that were trying to push the aircraft into the granite. He found Don Sheldon. For years, the two worked together, Washburn with his cameras and his precise requirements, Sheldon flying, holding the Cessna steady in turbulence that would have convinced most pilots to turn for home. Crossing passes on headings calculated to the degree, at altitudes that left them hundreds of feet above the ridges with nowhere near enough margin for error to feel comfortable. Washburn later said, in the careful way that precise men say things that mean more than they appear to, that Sheldon had a quality of concentration in the air that was unlike any other pilot he had ever flown with. The mountains produced Sheldon's complete and total attention, and his attention produced results. The maps that came from that partnership are still in use. Climbers on Denali today navigate with charts that owe their accuracy in part to those flights, to those thousands of passes over ridges and glaciers and faces in the 1950s and 60s. Now here's where it gets interesting. The Alaska Range in winter draws climbers from all over the world, Denali in particular, routes that demand technical skill and physical endurance at a level that pushes professional climbers right to the edge. And when those climbers get into trouble, which happens, the options for help are limited by altitude, distance, and weather. Sheldon became the lifeline.
In 1960, a Japanese climbing expedition attempting the south face of Denali encountered one of the Alaska Range's periodic catastrophic storms. The team was pinned at high altitude, frostbitten, with deteriorating supplies and deteriorating conditions. Getting help to them by conventional means was essentially impossible. Helicopters of the era could not operate reliably at that altitude. Walking out was not an option. The clock was running. Sheldon flew, in conditions that would have kept most pilots on the ground in Talkeetna. He flew toward the mountain, threading through passes with visibility measured in hundreds of feet, navigating by knowledge of the terrain when the clouds closed. What little visual reference remained, using his 30 years of familiarity with those specific ridges and bowls and passes to find gaps that existed, because he knew they would be there even when he could not see them. He could not land high on the mountain. The surface conditions and the altitude did not permit it, but he could drop. Supplies wrapped and bundled, passed out the door of the Super Cub as he made low passes over the stranded team, as close to the surface as the conditions allowed, in winds that were doing everything they could to end the flight early. The climbers who made it out owed part of their survival to what Sheldon delivered in those conditions. He did this kind of thing repeatedly across his career, not as part of a formal rescue service with procedures and oversight and liability waivers. As a pilot who knew the mountain, who answered the phone when it rang, and who was willing to go when going was what the situation required, in 1966, he built something on the Ruth Glacier that I find remarkable even now, thinking about it, at roughly 5,500 feet, in the great ice cirque surrounded by peaks so tall that looking up at them from the glacier makes your neck ache. Sheldon constructed a small hexagonal hut. He flew every piece of it in aboard the Super Cub, assembled it on the glacier himself.
He called it the Mountain House. Climbers and expedition teams used it as a way station, a place to regroup and wait out weather before pushing up onto the higher routes. It is still there. You can fly into the Ruth Glacier today and stay in that hut. People do it. They lie awake at night listening to the glacier settle and groan beneath them and the wind comes screaming off the peaks in a hut built by a bush pilot in the middle of country that has no business having a hut in it. That is the kind of mark a pilot can leave. Sheldon was known among mountaineers as the pilot who would fly when others would not, and known among other Alaska pilots as someone whose judgment was impeccable. Those two things can sound like they are in tension, they are not. The difference between recklessness and acceptable risk is calibrated knowledge. Sheldon knew the Alaska Range at a depth that no other pilot of his era could match, When he flew in conditions that looked impossible from Talkeetna, it was because he had information that made them less impossible than they appeared. He knew the passes, he knew the wind behavior around specific ridges at specific times of year. He knew what the clouds were doing in this cirque versus that one, and he knew why, because he had seen it thousands of times. He flew in that terrain for 30 years. That is the answer to any question about whether his judgment was sound. He died in January of 1975. Pancreatic cancer. 53 years old, by the accounts of people who knew him. He kept flying as long as his health allowed it, because it was what he did and who he was, and the mountain was there. His operation in Talkeetna continued. The airstrip, the routes, the methods he had developed and refined over 3 decades of glacier work, all of it passed on. Talkeetna Air Taxi still operates today. The pilots working the glacier routes to the Kahiltna and the Ruth are carrying the lineage of what Sheldon established, flying aircraft that are better than his, with weather information he never had, landing on surfaces he mapped by experience. Bradford Washburn, who outlived Sheldon by many years and kept talking about him for the rest of his own long life, consistently said that Sheldon was the finest mountain pilot he had ever encountered. Washburn had flown with a great many pilots in a great many mountain ranges over a great many decades. He did not say things like that casually. The great ice amphitheater on the Ruth Glacier, where the walls rise in a full circle of granite and ice that takes your breath away on the clearest day you will ever see, is known as the Sheldon Amphitheater, a piece of the Alaska Range named for the man who flew it. There are worse monuments. James Greiner's biography, Wager with the Wind, is as close to a definitive account of Sheldon's life as you will find, and Bradford Washburn's own writings fill in the survey years. Both sources shape today's segment, and both are worth your time. RadioHanger.com. I'm Taildragger. Go fly something.